I'm required to tell you this is KCSN and KCSN HD1 Northridge KSBR and KSBR HD1 Mission Viejo.
That's our legal name.
But this is the SoCal Sound, member-supported public radio for music lovers. Join us on the SoCal Sound app and the SoCalSound.org.
A very happy Wednesday evening to you all, and welcome to The Soundtrack. I'm your occasionally genial host, Lev L. Spiro, and we have a very cool guest tonight. He is an American songwriter, musician, producer, composer, and novelist. This is true. He's spent a lot of the last several decades working with Roland Orzabal, Kurt Smith, and Tears for Fears as their co-writer, co-producer, and touring and studio guitarist. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Charlton Pettis.
How you doing? That sounds like a lot.
It does sound like a lot. It is a lot. I mean, it's not making any of that up, right? This is all true.
All true.
Well, listen, I have so many questions to ask you about music, creativity, writing, touring, producing, also, you know, life in the universe. We know the answer to that is 42. But I'd love to start just putting some of your wonderful music in the ears of our listeners. So, written by Roland Orzabal, Charlton Pettis, and Kurt Smith, this is Long, Long, Long Time.
The higher the mountain, the harder the fall. Looking for blood at the scene of the crime. It's been running in circles or nothing at all.
Yeah.
long, long, long time from the 2022 release, The Tipping Point, from Tears for Fears. And we are here talking with one of the songwriters, one of the co-producers, and the guitarist, Charlton Pettis. Charlton, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you very much.
You told me that making that album was a great experience for you.
It was amazing. It was a long, long, long process. But, I think it all kind of started several years before it ended, and there was a lot of going in different directions, trying to figure out what the record was supposed to be. And then at some point, Kurt and Roland decided to kind of come back to the beginning, and just the three of us sat in a room and did all of it in about, 3 months maybe.
So this wasn't 2 years of expensive studio time kind of changing.
Oh, no, there was plenty of that too. I mean,
okay.
There was lots of writing with lots of people. There was lots of, management looking further and further afield for the next big hit or something. I mean, it was all the horror stories you hear. And at some point they decided to just come back, and I think someone's Saturn had returned, if I remember correctly.
Oh, God, spare me.
So there we were.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about songwriting. To me, just as an appreciative listener and enjoyer of music, is that a term? Enjoyer of music? To me, songwriting is a form of pure magic. I mean that. It's just like I'm stunned by what you do. But you once described songwriting like this. You said, generally, the universe gives you a little peace, and then the rest is just misery. That's a direct quote, Mr. Pettis.
I don't remember saying that, but it sounds about right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what you said is true. Like, it is magic, but like most magic, only a teeny bit of it's really magic. Most of it is, you get that freebie from the universe or God or whoever's giving you the good bit.
Mm-hmm.
But they never give you the whole thing. Like, they're like, okay, there you go. And then you have to make the other 3 minutes and 24 seconds up, and it has to all seem like, of course that's how it goes. How could it possibly have gone any differently?
Mm-hmm.
And that part's work. I mean, that's the crafty bit.
Is it helpful doing it with other writers as well, so somebody else can help fill in?
Sometimes
the crafty
yes.
Bit?
Sometimes wildly no.
Okay.
No, the hope is that the other person brings, the answer to the table, right? Like you've got the germ, and they say, "Oh, right," and then they're inspired and excited, and they do something great, and then everyone's just like, "Wow, we're brilliant," and we're done. And I think that happens in Nashville periodically. For the rest of us, it's. I think you're always kind of doubting and circling back and struggling to be worthy of the free bit.
It sounds like a lot of artistic endeavors. And this is a really interesting word, and you have drawn a distinction between the words art and craft. Even just now, you mentioned that the inspired bit was the art, and then trying to fill in the connective tissue between the inspired bits would be the craft. But what distinguishes those things from each other for you beyond what
I
just said?
I think we all kind of view it similarly. Craft is the part you do on purpose, and art is the part you don't. It's the freebie,
It's intentionality.
Yeah. I mean, craft is how you take the free bit, which is the art bit, and make a whole thing out of it. Because, the art bit is always just a little idea. It's like it's a line of lyric or a little bit of melody, and you're like, ooh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wait for the rest to come, and it never does, so you have to grind through it and kind of figure out what it is that you love about it and how to flesh out that thought and make a whole thing.
Grind through it, hence the misery that I mentioned in the first quote.
Are you a musical theater person?
Once upon a time, long ago.
Okay, so Stephen Sondheim? Yes, no, maybe?
Not for me.
Okay.
Sorry.
Finishing the Hat is the kind of classic musical theater magnum opus about this process. It's about a painter who's a pointillist, so he's literally sitting there for hours going, dot, 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 to make these pieces of art. And it's Sondheim's way of talking about how much of art is just the grind of getting it to great.
Mm. Interesting. So interesting. All right. We're talking a lot. Let me play some more music for our listeners. I like to kind of keep this illustrated with music.
This song came instantly all by itself, and it was totally done.
Well, now we know. Okay. Well, I just want to say, speaking for myself and for legions of fans, I'm very glad that you've worked through how to take these bits of art and apply your craft and make amazing music. So let's indulge in another musical sample, please. Written by Roland Orzabal and Charlton Pettis, this is The Tipping Point. The Tipping Point by Tears for Fears from the 2022 album of the same name. You're listening to the soundtrack here on the SoCal Sound. There you go, Mookie. Are you happy?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. We have in our studio one of the writers and producers of that song, Mr. Charlton Pettis. Charlton, you told me, going back to our songwriting conversation, you once told me that in order to let the inspired bits happen, you have to, quote, turn off the homunculus, the little man inside your head. Can you explain what the heck you're talking about to our listeners, please?
Yeah, I mean, it's like same thing as with meditation or anything like that. If you're trying to hear your subconscious or whatever you think of the smart, artistically good part of you, if you want to hear that voice, you have to shut up the other guy. And the other guy's, you know, usually saying stuff like, isn't it lunch? Or, you know, we only have another hour with the artist. We got to come up with something better than this.
My guys are much nastier than your guys. They're like, you suck. How do you call yourself a director?
I thought we weren't allowed to swear. I would have said the...
Well, suck is a lollipop.
Okay, sucks, okay. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, I mean, it's like, did you do the Carlos Castaneda books when you were little?
All right. Of course.
So, remember, the whole thing was just getting your internal monologue to shut up for 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're trying to write music particularly, you either kind of go over the same little section of music that you like and just kind of sing gibberish or try to let it all go and hope something good happens, or you try and bore yourself. You know, you try and, you know, at the beginning of a session, you'll kind of talk about all the sports stuff and the politics and get all of it out of the way, and then just try and be literally out of stuff to say.
Hmm.
So, you know, the little jabbery voice stops, and then after that, you still got to get lucky. So you're hoping for lucky, but if the voice doesn't stop, you have no shot. You're always kind of in the room too much. Like you're not really able to get anything creative.
Fascinating. Thank you. Thank you for explaining that. Now, I asked you about your musical influences last week. We both came of age in the 70s, and you mentioned listening as a kid to the Beatles, Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, what you called the usual chestnuts. Did I leave any out?
Yeah, I mean, it was all that stuff. I mean, I guess the Stones were in there, although, you know, in that era, you had to be a Beatles or a Stones person. Yeah.
Cream, Blind Faith,
Beatle person.
The Who.
Yeah, The Who was tricky, too, because, you know, Pete was cool, but Roger was like a little, like, you knew he didn't write the words, and you were just kind of like, I don't know about Roger.
You knew too much.
So, yeah, but, you know, Bowie was huge, and then later Prince, I mean... You know, it's all of us that age had the same sort of pile of stuff.
You're going to school in Boston in the early 80s before you go to New York City and start working as a session guitarist. So, guitarist, what did I say? Which bands did you love in the 80s? Let's talk 80s bands for a second.
You know, it's always a tricky subject because for 30 years they were all embarrassing. Like you say, you know, I loved Squirty Politti, which I did.
Uh-huh.
And people are like, oh, God, that's not okay.
You're admitting to that, yes.
No, totally. But you know,
Kaja Goo Goo? Were you a Kaja Goo Goo
no,
fan?
No.
Okay, you drew the line.
Let the record be crystal clear.
Okay, good. Yes.
But yeah, Squirty Politti, Prince again, like the Prince in the 80s was unbelievable. Bowie again, Peter Gabriel, Kate Bush, Cocteau Twins.
Elvis Costello.
I mean, yeah, Elvis Costello. Although I kind of had a, you know, bumpy ride with Elvis Costello.
Okay.
Sometimes he was great, and other times it was like, really?
What about The Clash?
Nope, never really a Clash
Not
person.
The Clash, okay.
Yeah.
All right, very interesting. Well, you did mention one of my all-time favorite songwriters, Andy Partridge and the band XTC, and it just so happens that I miraculously and inexplicably have an XTC cue lined up.
But that's incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible. But tell us, what was it about Mr. Partridge that you loved?
I mean, kind of everything. The sound of his voice, the smart of the words, the kind of... He had a very kind of dry, snarky kind of thing. And the juxtaposition of him and Colin, because Colin was... You know, a little more earnest, and I didn't really love the Colin thing so much, but Andy was, he was just cool, you know, like, and the words were brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, when I was wooing my wife a few decades ago, I did the heteronormative white boy thing and made her a mixtape, because that's what you had to do, and I included this cut from their 1992 album, Nonsuch. This is Then She Appeared.
Thank you.
With Then She Appeared, and we are visiting with Charlton Pettis, songwriter, composer, novelist, guitarist, producer. What am I leaving off? Bon vivant? Are you a bon vivant?
I'm not sure. I'm
you seem like you have an appreciation for the good things in life.
There are certain things I definitely like.
All right.
But bon vivant conjures up a bad kind of English guy in a bathrobe with gout thing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's
bad.
I don't
want to be that guy.
Okay. All right. No gout. Well, let me ask you this. You've been a co-producer of the last three Tears for Fears albums, and you've produced some really interesting albums for other artists as well. Does producing give you a type of creative satisfaction that is different than songwriting, or is that part of the process for you, like you need to produce to complete the songwriting process?
It's different with different projects, really. You know, there are times where, as the producer, you're sort of deciding what it is and trying to make it be the best version of whatever that is it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other times where you're not really producing at all. You're just kind of another guy in the room. You're another guy in the band. Like, you're another person to bounce stuff off of.
Interesting.
You know,
reflective board.
And then there are lots of other producers who really don't do any of those things. They just kind of wander by and say profound things. And
oh, it sounds a lot like
maybe
producing
some incense and leaves.
Incense, really?
Yeah.
Well, now, I have to tell our audience that we have the fabulous Mookie here in the studio with us tonight.
How are you?
Is that okay if I call you the fabulous
Mookie? Yeah, that's
Mookie?
Cool, man. I appreciate that so much.
Cool. The fabulous
TFM.
Yeah. You had a question for our guest, Mr.
No,
Pettis.
Well, you said some stuff that really resonated with me, you know, the art versus craft sort of concept, you know, and I think that I feel that in radio, you know, and also I'm definitely going to be looking up Finishing the Hat, which is...
was that Sondheim?
His book is called Finishing the Hat, and the sequel is Look, I Made a Hat or something like that. They're both lines from the song Finishing the Hat, but it's great.
And then off the air, you were talking about, like, I don't know, maybe a Rick Rubin type who, you know, shows up, burns some incense. I don't mean to put words into your mouth, but what kind of producer are you? How hands-on are you when it comes to that stuff?
I just try to be, unless I'm working with, you know, a young artist who doesn't really know who they are, in which case I'm trying to figure out what they are. But ordinarily, I'm just another guy in the room. Like, I'm another opinion. I'm another, like, you know, most people I work with, they play, I play. Everyone kind of is fighting over guitars and, you know, trying to play the piano part. And, you know, it's just kind of another thing to bounce off of.
A great question, Mookie. And you have, Charlton, worked with a variety of artists, ranging from pop to rock to country, folks like Kurt Smith, before your involvement with Tears for Fears, Michael Wainwright, Hilary Duff, Clay Aiken. Is there a through line? Is there a common aesthetic you bring to producing? Or is each project a fresh start, kind of its own animal?
I mean, I think it's one of those accidental careers, right? Like, you start out just as a player or an artist or something, and then you end up working on other people's stuff. And then, like, that whole pop thing happened totally accidentally. I wrote a song with a friend that ended up going on the Hilary Duff record that sold a bunch. And so all of a sudden I was getting those calls a lot, and I was like, I don't know anything about these kinds of records.
But money is good in America. With a K.
Yeah, but I don't think it was something I really understood.
Okay.
And it was an odd decade.
Well, congrats on the residual chain nonetheless. But let's take a listen to this. This is a cool track from an EP you recently produced for an artist named Lee Nash, and it features both Ms. Nash, who wrote the song, and Roland Orzabal on vocals. This is called Unraveling.
Every time I come undone, and I really need someone to pour some champagne and put everything back in its place. Well, you show up just in time. I'll never even ask me why I change by the day. You love me exactly the same. How do you do it? I always lose it. You hold me together when I'm unraveling.
Spread your love divine, like the seeds of a dandelion. Let them sail on the wind to the man who won't stop until you let him in. How do you do it?
I love you.
Traveling by Lee Nash, and that's from a new 2025 release called The Tide. That song was produced by our guest, Charlton Pettis. Charlton, I'm fascinated by the role of producer and how you shape the sound of a band or an album. But before we get into that, I need some remedial schooling, please. Okay, so you have a lot of credits in your CV, including, oh gosh, producer, written by, arranged by, mixed by, recorded by, engineer, and tracking by. The first two, producer, written by, they're a little more obvious, but can you, for example, clarify for us the difference between, say, recorded by and engineer?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of those terms are clear. I mean, in the modern world, written by can mean all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. It can mean, you know, brought drugs to the session.
Ah.
Or loaned us a bass. I mean,
for the kids listening, we're talking about Sudafed, of course.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, all those terms don't really mean very much. Mixed by does. Like, I have a lot of respect for mixed by because, you know, you're the guy who has to really decide what it is in the end. You know, you give two different mixers the same tracks, you get two different songs. And so, there's no hiding. Like, producer, there's tons of people you can blame. Mixer, it's you.
Mixed by and producer, are those kind of overlapping circles in the Venn diagram? Can they be the same thing?
They can be. Like, if the producer has a clear vision for what it is, they'll give you a rough mix of the track that tells you what it's supposed to sound like,
okay,
and you're just supposed to make it a little better. Like,
okay,
you know, clean up all the buzzes and hums and make it a little more hi-fi. But a lot of times you get tracks, and you know if you use all the tracks they've given you, it's going to be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So you literally are, as the mixer producing the record, you're turning stuff off, you're muting vocals, tuning vocals, doing whatever has to be done. I mean, you know who Spike Stent is?
I don't know the gentleman.
He's a very well-known mixer who is kind of the paradigm of the will do whatever has to be done to make it good, whether you gave me good or not.
Okay.
You know, and I think those guys are amazing.
Okay, one last stupid question for now. What the heck does tracking by mean? Are you NSA?
Sounds like that.
It does.
That's another one of those. Doesn't really mean anything. It could have been on when you record things for films, things get really crazy because you can't say recording engineer because that's someone else. So you say tracked by.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean anything. It
there's guys in like a little room somewhere just making titles up.
No, they just say, that's taken. I got to call you something else.
Okay. Well, I genuinely appreciate your explanations, such as they were. Back to producing. Let's talk about Tears for Fears. Now, what role do you play most often in that triumvirate?
Kind of what we were talking about earlier. Like, you know, I think it's usually that kind of ideal scenario where I'm another voice in the room. Everyone's got ideas. Everyone's got opinions. You know, at the end of the day, they decide what actually goes on the record. But, you know, there's a lot of freedom to just try a lot of stuff. And, you know, we definitely try a lot of bad ideas. And sometimes something works out. But, yeah, it's a very kind of three people in a room, everyone throwing a lot of stuff at the wall and seeing if they can convince someone else.
Well, let's listen to that trio at work right now. Here's the title track from the 2004 Tears for Fears reunion album, Everybody Loves a Happy Ending, co-produced by Charlton Pettis.
Thank you. Your time is nearly over. No more the supernova. No action guaranteed.
Darkness of the day, a curse in every way. You try to see the light, but you don't know why, don't know why. They tell you on the phone to give your God a bone and grow a set of wings like a butterfly. The guardian at the gate reminds you that you're late. You try to take your time, but you toe the line to children of the world and daddy's little girl. The grass is always greener on the other side, so stay and breathe new life.
You're listening to The Soundtrack on the SoCal Sound. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
This 4th of July, turn up the volume. It's our very first indie jam, only on the SoCal Sound. From 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., we're going all in on live music, powered by the SoCal Sound app. This Independence Day, free your ears, only on 88.5, the SoCal Sound.
Support for the SoCal Sound comes from Golden Voice, presenting David Byrne's Who Is the Sky Tour, stopping by Dolby Theater on November 21st and 22nd. Tickets are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. David Byrne, Dolby Theater, November 21st and 22nd.
The man who defied the odds is back. And he's more resilient than ever. The Matt Pinfield Show. Weekdays at 4 p.m. on the SoCal Sound.
Welcome back. I'm Lev L. Spiro. You're listening to The Soundtrack, and our esteemed guest is Charlton Pettis. Charlton, you have spent a good chunk of the last few years creating, writing, and composing a television series that aired this year for Disney. It's called Kindergarten the Musical. Congrats, first of all, for getting a TV show
Thank
on the air.
Much.
No mean feat, that. But tell us about it.
I mean, the name sort of sums it up. It's a very straightforward pitch. It is about kindergarten, and it is a musical. So every episode is an 11-minute little mini-musical, and our little protagonist, Birdie, and her friends go through the arc you would imagine, solving problems, singing songs. It's great.
And you created the show. You came up with the idea for it.
Yeah, but that distilled down to basically saying in a room, I know, Kindergarten, the musical.
Well, you're really demystifying the whole process now. Well, how involved were you in the writer's room? Were you helping craft the storylines for the 50 episodes you did, these 11 minutes?
Yeah. I mean, since it's musical, the adjustment for everyone but us was getting used to the idea of song-driving narrative. So, you know, we were kind of tyrants about the music thing. Like, you know, whatever the three songs were, those were the tent poles that the story was built on. So, you know, the resolution, the setup, and usually the big turn where the problem either becomes unbearable or gets resolved. These were all songs, and we had to kind of establish that before they wrote the script. So
you're doing three songs per 11-minute episode.
Right.
Like somewhere between 7 and 10 minutes of music each episode.
Well, songs are pretty short. They're all about a minute and a half long.
Okay.
So,
but
yeah,
still,
like
you're
5 minutes of music and
you wrote
5 minutes of
150 songs for this TV series?
Yes.
That's insane. Would you repeat this experience given the chance?
Yes.
Wow. Okay,
no, it's funny. I think I realized that songs should be about a minute and a half.
Okay.
You know, we were talking about the art craft thing. Mm-hmm. It kind of takes most of the craft burden away because it's the good bit and another bit that moves the story, and then you're done. It's
interesting. Over. Well, we're going to talk about novel writing if we have time in a little bit, but tell us, I'm curious. Talk a little bit about having characters express story and emotion through song as opposed to prose. Is that more challenging? Is it more fun?
I think it's more fun. I mean, I think the reason we were excited about it as a show for kids in the first place is the musical theater's big magic trick is you get to know what people are thinking, right? So in a normal show, characters talk, and the viewer has to extrapolate what they're thinking from what's implied in the conversation.
Right.
In a musical, spotlight snaps on, they turn to camera and tell you exactly what they're thinking.
That sounds
freeing. I'm scared. I want to go home. Hmm. Why is everyone being so mean to me? Like, I mean, that's, especially for a show for kids, it's magical to be able to say exactly what the characters are feeling.
Well, I want to play a little sample of this. This is one of the songs that you wrote, and I just want to call the audience's attention to the fact that you put this rip-roaring electric guitar solo into it, which I love. It's like you're indoctrinating the kids into rock and roll from a very young age.
I think kids love rock, right?
They think they do now. Let's check this out. This is from Kindergarten the Musical. This one is called Book Drive.
Yay!
Dinosaurs. Well, I did it.
You did it?
Okay, I did.
Hey! Yay! Hey, hey, hey! We're having a book drive, a book day. And it's gonna be great!
The Fabulous Bouncy Bunny Band. Mommy and Poppy used to read it to me every night. I heard it so many times, I knew every word by heart. Now that I think about it, it's probably why I love music so much. And Bunny!
I mean, that's a great power pop tune. You swap out the voices, and that could have been a great Queen song. I hope that's not offensive to you. But maybe instead of books, you could have made the lyrics about bears, you know, who like to wear leather.
I feel like, I mean, to me, it's more Jellyfish than Queen. But yeah, I feel like Jellyfish would do a song about books.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, San Francisco, why not?
Yeah. Well, speaking of power pop, when you and I spoke last, one of the artists you brought up to me was the band Jellyfish, you just mentioned, who put out two sparkling pop albums during the height of grunge music in the early 90s. So I'm kind of getting a through line here from Beatles to XTC to Jellyfish. Am I way off base? Is there connective tissue?
These are all kind of post-Beatle pop things.
So tell us why Jellyfish in particular is meaningful to you. Is it primarily the songwriting, the production?
Everything. Both? Like the records sounded perfect. Like they were, you know, for that era, I think those were the best sounding records out there. I mean, I forget who mixed those.
I don't know.
Joseph Puig, maybe.
It's interesting.
They were bright and perfect and kind of.
And diametrically opposite to everything that was happening at the time.
Right, totally. I mean, it happened at
Nirvana,
the same time as grunge.
And
the world did not care about Jellyfish, but all the musicians were obsessed. I mean, it was like what happened with Radiohead later. It was like everyone was talking about it then.
Well, let's take a listen. So this is from their first album, Belly Button, which came out in 1990. This is the band Jellyfish with That Is Why.
Though it's hard to admit it's true, I've come to depend on you.
Thank you.
So here are a few of the bands that have cited Jellyfish as an influence. The Shins, James Mercer, OK Go, Panic at the Disco, Tame Impala, Ben Folds Five, and Beck, and Charlton Pettis. That's an impressive list.
I think it was impressive even before I showed up.
Even before then. Well, you're very self-deprecating, sir. Charlton, I was fascinated to hear you speak a little while back about the competing fantasies, this is the word you used, projected by pop music and by country music. Can you speak to that a little bit, if you remember talking about it?
I don't, but I mean, it's true. Like in pop music, you're selling this, you know, whether it's in the club and you're telling people the story that they want to hear, right? It's mm-hmm. very much about making the listener the focus of whatever the dream is, you know, whether it's attention, love, you know, you're selling the dream.
Okay.
And country is, it's this whole other thing. You're trying to make people relate, right? So you're not giving them an elevated aspirational story. Mm-hmm. You're trying to be the real world, right? You're trying to tell these eternally true stories.
Very interesting. So do you think these attitudes are ingrained in the popular culture now? Like, if we set out to write a country song, you already know this is what is expected of you? Or has it come the other way around?
I think kind of. Like, I mean, it's all kind of gray area-ing a little bit now, but I feel like, you know, a country audience has certain expectations, and mm-hmm. I think they get justifiably cranky when, you know, you get too pop with the story you're telling them.
Well, we're all cranky these days, let's be honest. But that's fair. Well, let me play another song that you produced for an artist named Chloe Catt. If it's not full-on country, it's at least country adjacent. And you put a banjo in it, so there's that. Do you want to tell us anything about this song, How Deep?
I mean, there's not too much to tell. She's a great artist. She's one of those ones where, you know, she comes in and sings the song and you're like, whoa. So you just try and frame it okay. But she's magic, I think.
Cool. Well, let's take a listen. This is produced by Charlton Pettis, and the song is How Deep by Chloe Catt.
One day I'll get to heaven. Till then I really want to know. How tall is the mountain? How deep does the river really go? Will I ever get the answer?
Charlton, since 2004, in addition to co-producing and co-writing with Roland and Kurt, you've been their touring guitarist, I think, on 8 world tours, if my counting is correct, along with keyboardist Doug Petty and drummer Jamie Wallum. Did I say his name correctly?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. How do you like touring? Is it one of the high points? Is it a grind? Is it both?
Yeah, it's definitely all of the above. I mean, the traveling thing gets brutal, but going out there is still amazing. I mean,
yeah.
it's kind of crazy.
And you're,
like,
you look out,
it's just like, wow.
I tell the audience that his eyes are lighting up as he says.
No,
this.
It's like particularly like any arena kind of thing where you feel like, you know, all of a sudden you're in Almost Famous or Song Remains the Same. It's like you look out and it's that view. It's like, whoa.
Oh, that's got to be incredibly powerful to play for 18,000 people. You've played at huge venues like the Forum, the Hollywood Bowl here in L.A. You've also played to mid-sized theaters like Shepherd's Bush Empire in London, a couple thousand people. Do you prefer one over the other? Does the show differ in energy or theatricality? What do you like?
Yeah, I mean, the standard rule is the smaller it is, the more terrifying it is. I think that's kind of a universal experience. Like playing a small club is terrifying. We played Hyde Park, which was a jillion people. Rock in Rio was a jillion people. You know, it kind of, you know, that Zeppelin song, The Ocean, it turns into the ocean.
Right.
Like it's just a sea of people, and it's super powerful. Like you feel all that energy come towards you, but like a club with 13 people on their chairs, like, yeah, that's terrifying.
Oh my God, because you're seeing the people, the individuals.
It's just, it's horrible.
Well, I'm guessing that the set list may vary slightly, but it's basically the same from gig to gig. How do you keep it fresh for yourself? Or is it just the energy of the live crowd that keeps it vibrant?
Yeah, it's
for
the
you?
People. You know, since I'm not the main singer, I don't have to kind of do that middle distance, I'm looking at everyone thing.
Yeah,
so I get to look at people, like individual people. And it's crazy. Like it's such a kind of rush.
Charlton, it has been a real honest pleasure. You are truly an interesting human being. I wish we had another hour to continue, Mookie. But what is next for you, sir? What do we have to look forward to from your many and varied creative undertakings?
You know, we're starting to write some Tears songs, see what happens with that.
Awesome.
Trying to see what's happening in kid TV world, TV world.
Public radio benefit show, perhaps.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, the usual suspects.
Right. Well, we thank you again for coming over here tonight and sharing a little bit of your life with us. It really was just fascinating. Ladies and gentlemen, that is all the time we have for now. I'm so sorry. I'm going to leave you with one more song from Charlton, Roland, and Kurt from their album, The Tipping Point. This is Rivers of Mercy.
Well, the streets have started burning. There's trouble in the towns. Guess the devil loves his playground. That's for sure. I too often see the world through a veil of tears. Well, to hell with my immunity. Gonna hold you close till the shadows disappear.